Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Roundtable Webinar on Budget 2015 and Redesigning Fund Structures. This event is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates. The speakers are Mr. Rajesh Simon, Head International Tax, Nishit Desai Associates, Mr. Ruchi Sancheti, Head Fund Formation Practice, Nishit Desai Associates, and Mr. Aditya Srinivasan, Senior Member, Fund Formation Practice, Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the session over to Mr. Ruchi Sancheti. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thanks, Karuna, and good morning and welcome all who have joined on the telephone line, as well as to all the members of the audience who have been kind enough to sort of do an in-person participation into the event. So I think to begin with, just wanted to summarize that what the agenda that we're discussing today, which is on taxation for alternative investment funds, is one of the most key attributes based on which we set up the fund platform. To begin with, any structure designed to pool investors globally as well as in India, Indian context, one would need to make sure that from a tax perspective, it is A, certain, and B, it is neutral. We continue harping on this point because this has been a very sticking point for the industry for over a decade now. And just to make sure that, you know, we are all on the same page what we mean by certain and neutral. By certain, you would mean that because the funds are long-term structures, they invest in illiquid investment opportunities. It is a very, you know, key requirement that to set up a platform where you can encourage investors to participate on a long-term basis, you allow them some amount of certainty on how the taxation would work in the entire structure. So when an income is received by the fund or when the fund makes a distribution back to the investors, there should be certainty at which level what would be the taxation on different streams of income. That critically comes in forms of treaty when we are talking in context of offshore funds. But unfortunately, when it is the discussion context of onshore funds, we are looking at the letter of the law which comes in every year in format of the Finance Act. So here we are talking about something on whether an entity which is in the form of alternate investment fund, what is the neutrality and certainty that it can offer. Neutrality is another aspect which is critical because it allows the investors to an onshore fund be taxed on the same basis had they invested directly into the portfolio investments directly, as if the layer of the investment fund would not have had existed. Now, just to summarize what we have seen from historical perspective on how onshore funds have been taxed. To begin with, we had a regime where venture capital funds set up under the VCF regulations of 1996. They were exempt from any income that arose to a venture capital fund under the provisions of venture capital fund regulations. A dispute arose at some point in time that, okay, if the fund is doing a temporary parking of funds in fixed deposits or, you know, money market instruments, would they be afforded the same amount of pass-through status on taxation as in case of other income? The High Court ruled in favor of the fund. They said that, okay, short-term parking of funds does not mean that there has been a shift of the venture capital fund or it is no longer investing as per the provisions of the venture capital fund regulation. So taking note, the department made the first serious amendment to the Tax Act. They said that, okay, it has to be an income from investments made under the perspectives of VCF regulations. So clearly the tax department wanted to make a case that, okay, if you are doing temporary parking of funds or if there is a return coming from fixed deposits or money market instruments, the tax department can still make a case that, okay, there should not be a pass-through or that should be taxed at the fund level. The next big shift in the tax regime for onshore funds came in 2007. When the amendments made to Section 1023 FB articulated that a pass-through status would only be afforded in case a venture capital fund invested in 9 to 10 identified sectors. So in case of other sections, the certainty on pass-through was no longer there. That is for the first time that an attempt was made by the fund industry that, okay, if we are not going to be taxed as per the provisions of 1023 FB, can we rely on other modes of taxation for a fund structure? More critically, the determinate nature then became very relevant. That, okay, if a trust has been set up in a format which is determinate, you know who your investors are, you know what is their beneficial interest into the fund. Can that be taken as a basis that the pass-through should be given on a look-through basis? The fund should not be taxed, but the investors directly should be taxed. Again to this, there was another spin to the whole thing when CBDT came out with a circular in July 2014. That circular said that, okay, even for a determinate trust, two or three key attributes have to be there. A, you should know who your investors are. B, you should know what is their beneficial interest. And most critically, it should be at the time of creation of the trust itself. So this again led to a lot of confusion in the industry that, okay, if we are to be determinate, are we to ensure that on day one itself, when the fund is undergoing an initial closing, should we know who all our investors are? The other issue which arose as a corollary was that, okay, what if the fund is, you know, having multiple closings? By multiple closing, I mean a new investor is participating onto the fund. What also in case if an investor forfeits? So all those issues came up and there was a lot of confusion on can a fund satisfy the determinate criteria or not. Thankfully, the ITAT, Income Tax Appeal Authority, it came out with an order in case of ICICI Ventures, India Advantage Fund, which clearly also allowed revocability as an added attribute based on which a fund could then claim that, okay, we are a pass-through in nature. Revocability means that any of the constituents, either the contributor or the trustee, etc., had the ability to revoke the fund. The court also recognized the principle of contingent revocability. It need not be an actual case of revocation, but even the documents allowing for such form of revocability can be taken as a basis for the fund to be taxed on a pass-through. The final issue then arose case of the finance bill currently that we are, you know, going to examine in more detail, where the tax department or the CBDT, which, you know, has come out with a proposal which completely revamps the basis on which funds in India are to be taxed. There are a lot of nuances which have now been thrown into the mix, including is it not a true pass-through at all? Because if you introduce, you know, aspects like withholding, if you introduce aspects that losses cannot be taken, you know, credit by the investors, but can only be carried forward by the fund for, you know, adjustments against subsequent years, etc. Is now the onshore AIF platform any longer a true pass-through in nature or not? I think to that extent, the panel today will discuss the different attributes, what are the features that the new tax bill has sort of thrown into the mix, what are the implications of the industry, and what implications does it mean for future setups or the different structures that we currently are working on for some of our investors and some of you may be operating those structures. So with this, I will ask Aditya, my colleague, to sort of summarize what are the key features in the new tax regime for alternate investment funds that the finance bill is trying to propose.
Sure. I think just before I get into that, I'll make a couple of brief points on, you know, just to give some context over how this regime has come, why it's come, etc. I think in 2012, when SEBI really introduced the alternative investment fund regulations, they divided alternative investment funds into three different categories. Category 1 AIFs, which were generally identified as investment funds which would have some positive spillover to the economy. Category 2 AIFs, which, you know, gave examples of private equity funds and hedge funds. And then you had Category 3 AIFs, which had a complex or diverse trading strategy and included hedge funds as well. Now, the reason that this really became an issue is that you had a lot of applicants that went to SEBI and who really had a private equity strategy, but who were trying to characterize themselves as a Category 1 AIF under the Venture Capital Fund category, subcategory, in order to take the benefit of Section 10, Subsection 23 FB. But when SEBI evaluated the application, they found that, you know, this application was more in the nature of a Category 2 AIF and actually asked fund managers to revise their applications and resubmit as Category 2 AIFs, so that's the case maybe, Category 3 AIFs as well. And as a consequence, you had a lot of fund managers over the course of the last one and a half, two years who were in a difficult situation with respect to fundraising because they had to establish tax certainty to their investors. And in the absence of, and you know, Richie spoke about the July 28, 2014 circular as well, in the absence of having all closings happen at one single point, of a single first closing, if you will, they found they often had difficulties with respect to establishing tax certainty to the investors. So that really was the context for why you now have a new regime, which is formulated under Chapter 12 FB of the, you know, of the new proposed Chapter 12 FB of the Income Tax Act. So what is the Finance Bill 2015 really done with respect to alternative investment funds? It's defined a new concept of investment fund as category, as including all Category 1 AIFs and all Category 2 AIFs. And the first provision, you know, Section 115 UB, subsection 1, says that the unit holders of an investment fund, the income arising or received by the unit holders of an investment fund, will partake of the same character, the same nature, and in fact of the same proportion as the income that is received or accrues to the investment fund. In other words, the character of the income arising to the investment fund will be the same as the character of the income arising to the unit. They also introduced subsection 2 with respect to how losses should be treated. Now, it's useful to remember that, you know, under a determinate trust or under the concept of revocable transfers, it was possible for the losses that arise to an alternative investment fund to really be upstreamed to the contributor, and for these losses to be set off as, you know, against a contributor or an investor's other income. But Chapter 12 FB and Section 115 UB of the Income Tax Act provides that losses can't really be upstream. They can't be passed through to the investor. They will have to be set off and carried forward within the investment fund itself. So it's set a category of an investment fund and provides for the set off and carry forward of losses with respect to the income of that investment fund alone. Then you had the concept of a business income, or income that is chargeable under the head of profits and gains of business and profession. So what the new Chapter 12 FB proposes is that income other than income chargeable under the head of profits and gains of business will be passed through to the investors. In respect of income that is in the nature of profits and gains of business, they will be taxed at the investment fund level itself. If it's a case of a trust, it will be taxed at the maximum marginal rate. If it's a case of a format other than a trust, it will be charged at the applicable income tax rate. Now, the next provision was with respect to, you know, not applying chapters 12D and 12E with, you know, of the Income Tax Act, which relate to the dividend distribution tax and the buyback tax. The reason that this was probably introduced is because they wanted to encourage fund managers to consider setting up alternative investment funds in the format of a company as well. And so to the extent that income and proceeds had to be upstream in the format of dividends or the buyback of shares, you know, the withholding with respect to dividends, dividend distribution tax and the buyback tax would not apply in this regard. And then you had the next provision, which was with respect to a deemed credit of income. So what Chapter 12 FB, Section 115 UB, Subsection 6 says is that in respect of income that is paid or credited, if income is not paid or credited, it will nevertheless be deemed to be credited to the account of the unit holder, you know, in the same proportion as the unit holder has interest in the investment fund. And the reason that this really becomes relevant is when we go to the next provision that we look at, which is Section 194 LBB. Now, one of the key features of this regime is a withholding of 10% on the income of the investment fund, which is passed through to the investor. As you may remember from what I had mentioned, the taxation of investment funds happens at two levels. One is with respect to you know, income other than profits and gains of business. This is the income that is passed through to the unit holders, and the taxation happens at the unit holder level. And the others with respect to income in the nature of profits and gains of business. With respect to the first category of income, Section 194 LBB provides that tax will be withheld at 10%. And with respect to income that is chargeable under the head of profits and gains of business, this withholding provision does not really apply. But interestingly, the income tax also provides that in respect of income that is deemed to be credited into, say, a suspense account, tax will nevertheless have to be withheld at 10% in those scenarios.
Fair enough. So Rajesh, the key features what I could gather was this imposition of 10% withholding any time that the fund upstreams any income to the investors. And second one was that the current losses cannot be sort of passed through to the investors, but can only be carried forward in subsequent years for the fund to sort of absorb. So what are the key implications you believe this would bring about for the onshore fund industry?
Sure. I think when you're looking at it, and this is where there's sort of a divergence from what you look at as a global standard, where you're effectively looking at a fund as an absolute pass-through in many senses of the term. And here we have sort of had a divergence where the finance bill actually makes a distinction between as far as losses are concerned. Now, obviously, the challenge that you're going to have is the fact that that let's say as an investor, if I already have other subsisting losses that are actually there, I can't really offset that against, or if I have any other profits that are there, I can't offset it against any losses which I actually get from the fund or due to any bad investment at all. And today, when you think back, you're actually going through a phase where there are a lot of funds of the 2007-8 vintage, where there have been substantial amount of losses which are actually there. And here you're sitting in a position where you actually have to necessarily offset it within the fund and not necessarily offset it at the investor level. I think to a certain extent, this would, at least under certain circumstances, it will be an issue as far as LPs are concerned. And again, that's something that each one has to really deal with, saying that, well, unless I have other profitable deals in the fund, really, I cannot really have any degree of offset. The second one is really the point relating to the withholding red with the fact that you're crediting the amount at the end of the year, irrespective of the fact whether a distribution has been made or not. So there, I think that's more of what I would call a mark-to-market sort of analysis, where you're effectively saying that irrespective of whether there's actual distribution, I'm essentially going to create a deeming friction that you have made a distribution. And that goes back to the whole pass-through nature, because what you're effectively saying that the beneficiaries or the LPs, the income of the fund essentially partakes the same nature as the investment that's made by the LPs. So therefore, to a certain extent, that sort of goes along with what you would look at even as an international standard, where you're effectively doing a mark-to-market. The challenge is going to be really on the withholding, and withholding can happen under two circumstances. Now, the first one is that where you have essentially where you have domestic investors who are coming in, and the second is when you have offshore investors who are coming in into a potentially a unified structure, or in other cases where other foreign LPs directly come into the Indian AIF. As far as domestic investors are concerned, unless I have essentially tax-exempt investors who are really coming in, for whom it will be a bit of a challenge. In other cases, it should not be too much of a... in other cases, the 10% anyway, it's only a withholding tax. They will anyway get a credit for it and pay the tax. As far as tax-exempt investors are concerned, again, there it's going to be an issue, though I think there are certain old circulars which effectively provide that if you're a tax-exempt investor, there is a possibility that you can say that even a withholding tax should not be applied. In any case, depending on the way your fund is structured, you may even require your tax-exempt investors to possibly go and get a 197 certificate. Say that, well, at least as far as the tax-exempt investors are concerned, I don't want to actually withhold any, the 10% withholding tax that is there. The second big category is foreign investors. And this is where it's actually a bit tricky right now, because you have two provisions which are actually going to be applicable at this point in time. You have Section 195, which is a catch-all sort of provision, which says that when you're making any payment to a non-resident, you have to withhold, if the sum is chargeable to tax, then you have to withhold tax at the appropriate rates imposed. And you have the new provision that has been introduced, which imposes a 10% tax as far as AIFs are concerned. If you go back historically, and this goes back to, I think, 1996 when we had the AIG decision, where essentially that was a case where you had Mauritius investors who are coming into an Indian trust, and they're applying the principles of trust taxation. Essentially, the argument that was raised before the advanced ruling authority was that well, as far as any income which is arising to the trust, since the investor is actually a Mauritius investor, all of the, to the extent that it's a determinate trust, as far as capital gains are concerned, I'm going to rely on the treaty between India and Mauritius to say that no tax is applicable, and consequently, the corollary of that was that there will not be any withholding tax also coming. But here you have a situation where you have a special provision which effectively says that, well, there is a 10% tax. Having said that, I think to my mind, the question is whether you can impose an artificial tax, because 195 effectively is a special provision as far as non-residents are concerned, to say that they will be taxed only at the rates in force if the sum is chargeable to tax. So if the fund is making investments which are capital investments and they're getting capital gains, to that extent, the argument is still there saying that they should, as far as non-resident investors in the AIF are concerned, they should still be governed under the provisions of 195 and not under the provisions of 194 LBA. So argue that the 10% withholding tax should not apply, but it should actually become the potentially the treaty rate, or if you're coming in from a tax-exempt jurisdiction, then no tax should actually be withheld. But obviously, this particular issue is going to create some degree of issues because obviously it's not been tested till now, and there have not been any clarifications or anything that have also been made. So I think that is going to be a tricky area. But having said that, I think there is still a good argument to say as to why no withholding tax should be imposed. I think the third and something that is positive is the fact that portfolio companies don't need to withhold tax. I think that's actually pretty positive, because especially in situations where you had, let's say, there are two situations where you had interest income, or potentially also in situations where you had a AIF having foreign investors also. So the question of do I withhold, do I not withhold, what is the rate at which I withhold, how do I ensure that the on whose name is the TDS going to be deducted? That was a huge industry issue that was there. So I think the fact that they've taken away the withholding taxes as far as the portfolio companies are concerned, I think that's a huge positive, at least in terms of bringing about a lot of clarity as far as upstreaming of amounts from the portfolio companies are concerned.
Right. No, just to summarize, I think the point on the withholding as far as the portfolio companies upstreaming income or cash flows to the fund are concerned, I think a separate circular is awaited for that. The current construct of the finance bill does not provide for a non-withholding of taxes. It is just a statement of purpose under the overall memorandum that was issued to back up the finance bill. That's one. Secondly, just to take point Rajesh's implication on what this withholding introduces, I think just to give a little background, one of the largest institutional investors in India, which also happens to be an exempt investor sort of a category investor, they at one point in time had stopped allocating to category 2 AIFs for the same reason that the assurance on pass-through was not there. So we in the past had sort of issued notes just to say that, okay, even if there is no clear articulation under 1023 FD as far as pass-through is concerned, especially for category 2 AIFs or any category 1 AIF which is other than a venture capital fund, there at least you could still make a strong case on the fund being able to rely on the determinate nature, as well as that the fund, given the new order by the authority in case of India Advantage Fund, that it is a revocable in nature. But there also what we have seen a couple of months leading up to the budget announcement, the institutional investor in under discussion had completely frozen on making any fresh allocations to category 2 AIF. So whenever we last had a discussion with some of the GPs who are interacting, what came out is that they are still assessing whether to start now allocating again to category 2 AIFs, and number two, whether the thinking in the perspective of the institutional investor is, does it want to take the nature of a DFI, a development sort of a fund, so where they will only allocate to category 1 AIFs, because like Aditya indicated, category 1 is where the government believes there is a positive spillover effect on the economy. But I think on the withholding point, just to summarize, it impacts on two levels. One, when the fund is getting income which is exempt from tax, like in case of dividends which has been distributed by a portfolio company, or in case where the fund has invested on listed securities where the holding period was over 12 months. And accordingly, once you have sort of paid the securities transaction tax, there is no subsequent layer of tax to be imposed. On these sort of payments being upstreamed, an artificial layer of a 10% withholding just, you know, screws up the fund economics, how you're upstreaming the cash flows, what your LPs are getting, how do they get a credit of the withholding that has already been suffered on income, which ideally should not have suffered taxes. And also on the nature of the investor, whether is he an exempt investor or is he relying on a tax treaty where that particular stream of income is not to be taxed.
So I think one of the points, and here, the point that you raised, saying that, let's say if the fund has earned exempt income, whether it is going to be potentially dividends which have been subject to dividend distribution tax or capital gains arising by way of sale of shares on the stock exchange where STT has been paid. I think there is one of the arguments that you raise is, that can be raised is the fact that what 194 LBA really provides for is it says that where any income is actually distributed to the LPs, then there is a withholding tax. Whereas when you go back to the exemption which is there under Section 10, which is what you're really relying on, both for dividends subject to DDT and for capital gains subject to STT. Your argument there is that what Section 10 really provides for is that these particular streams of payouts don't even qualify as income in the first place. And therefore, to that extent, you can still go back and take the argument that when I'm making this distribution of, let's say, I'm upstreaming dividends which I've received, or I'm upstreaming capital gains which I received from sale of shares on the floor of the stock exchange, and I get long-term capital gains, these don't even form part of income because of the nature of the language set out under Section 10. And therefore, to that extent, there is not even a requirement of potentially payment of withholding tax. Again, the challenge that's going to be there is that that's an interpretation that is there. And knowing how Indian tax authorities are, we can expect some degree of back and forth and some degree of litigation on some of these. But at least I think the way that you have to look at it is the fact that 194 LBA, the intent behind the provision is to essentially impose some degree of withholding tax at the time when there is a distribution of income which ought to have been taxable rather than income which ought not to have been taxable.
Right. So I think a crucial link in the entire mix would be what is the position also taken by the trustees. See, because if you sort of come down to reality of the thing, the trustee, if the fund has been set up in a trust format, the trustees tend to take a slightly conservative view on how, you know, what positions you're efficient. In fact, some of the trustees in certain cases have also insisted that a reserve or a provision be made out of the cash flows, so that in case after the fund has been wound up, if any tax implications does arise, the trustee can sort of, you know, take care of those tax issues using the provisions you have created. So I think this goes back, dovetails, and, you know, to the same situation, that if the fund has been set up in the format of a trustee upfront itself, you should have a complete discussion with the trustee that, okay, given that if the position floor were not to change any further from the date on which the fund is being set up, what is the position that the trustee is going to take? So accordingly, you have some amount of certainty coming back to the entire structure. So when you discuss a particular format with a LP, and if the investor were to ask you what is the position on tax going to be, you can give a very well articulated position which you believe in all honesty that the trustee will also back up. Of course, if there is a change of provision under the 1023FD or other sections which have implications, then of course you'll have to go back to the trustee and sort of reconfirm the view. And just to add, there has been a situation where, you know, the trusteeship business in India as far as AIFs were concerned was sort of monopolized with one of the operators, but we clearly are seeing two or three other players also emerging recently, so which again offers a lot of alternatives to the whole mix as far as trusteeships are concerned. Aditya?
Yeah, so I think the point on the views that the trustee takes, etc., is very important. See, let's not forget the main purpose of introducing this Chapter 12 FPA. The idea was to offer tax certainty with respect to how investment funds are supposed to be taxed. Now, it's a different debate as to whether this has actually been achieved or not and whether there are interpretational issues or not. But I think the key point remains that to the extent that there is certainty and there is you know, a fair degree of when you're able to take a view on this is exactly how the taxation needs to be, that needs to happen. I think this needs to be acknowledged by all the players, all the participants in the fund structure, including the trustee. And to that extent, you know, documentation becomes very important because you need to really think in terms of whether you want to have unlimited indemnity provisions to make whole, you know, any taxes that arise, or even for that matter, whether you want to have give back provisions which extend back to several years post the termination of the fund, with respect to a contributor's obligation to pay back amounts to the fund for meeting tax liability. The other quick point I'll just make is, you know, this point on the exemption for capital gains tax on listed equity shares and sale of listed equity shares is particularly relevant to Category 2 AIFs because they are actually allowed to have a certain play in listed securities. So the fact that you have this uncertainty with respect to the withholding on that amount is, in a sense, a dampener on the possible potential strategies that a Category 2 AIF can really play.
I think changing tack and moving on to the next on the commercial side, given the buoyant, you know, mood around India and how the entire Indian alternate asset class is now emerging, the appetite for India risk is increasing as far as foreign investors are also concerned. So we see a lot of Series 1, Series 2 fund managers now launching platforms which also has capabilities to take offshore commitments. So there is a spin to it. Either you rely on one of the announcements made in the budget speech delivered by the finance minister that they would open up foreign investments directly into AIFs. So accordingly, you can take a call that should be set up an onshore fund with an ability to raise offshore commitments directly at the pooling vehicle in India. Or could you take a call whether should we set up a two-layer structure where my offshore investors, LPs, are acquiring shares of a foreign fund which could be dollar-denominated IRR hurdles, etc., which invest directly into the onshore fund. So you have a unified form. Unified versus co-investment is also another debate, but I think just to settle the issue, key drivers of deciding whether you offer a unified or a co-investment structure tends to be how is the management team sort of structured. If the team is entirely based out of India, and accordingly you could have difficulty in demonstrating that there is an offshore presence of control and management, or the team is there which can, you know, take calls for the offshore fund, most of the fund managers tend to operate out of a unified structure so that you can extract your commercials, the 2 and 20 or any variations to that at the onshore level itself. So you aggregate the corpus of the offshore pool as well as the onshore pool and you come out with a unified structure. So now the question arises that part of the proposal of the budget speech by the finance minister, it indicated that you can now raise offshore investors directly into the onshore fund. Now while we are yet to see the actual text of a circular to come out to this effect, it is anticipated by the industry currently that under the proposed FDI policy, which we believe should come out sometime in April, a proposal could be made that onshore AIFs, perhaps Category 1 and Category 2, could receive offshore investments. It could be made subject to EB approval. They could introduce who the eligible foreign investors are. Perhaps it could be limited only to FPCIs, as was the case under the previous venture capital fund regime. But that text is yet to come out. So given the discussions that we have had on the withholding tax issue on 10%, what do you think would be the flavor, Rajesh, for such fund operators who are looking to raise offshore commitments also? Should they do a single layer onshore or should they do a two layer offshore onshore structure?
I think the trend that you're probably going to see is people largely going towards a unified structure, because even if you have, let's say, the investors coming in directly into the Indian AIF, they're going to have two or three challenges. One is that they're coming within the Indian tax net, which effectively means that they have to file returns, they have to be subject to audit and assessment by the Indian tax authorities. The second challenge is going to be around the withholding tax issue. So even if you go down the path that, let's say, as far as the investor is concerned, I'm going to go under Section 195 and not under 194 LDA. The question that's going to be there is that, what if the investor is a U.S. pension fund? Where is really the tax resistance of the foreign investor, and how the withholding tax will sort of come into play as far as the foreign investor is concerned? So I think even from that perspective, they would rather prefer coming in into a one pool offshore pooling vehicle, which will then invest into the onshore fund. So I don't really see a situation where there'll be too many participants who'll be wanting to raise just one single AIF with all foreign investors coming in into the domestic AIF, because you're then taking a larger element of India risk in many senses of the term. Regulatory perspective, the fact that you're within really the gamut of the Indian authorities, as opposed to being one step away from it, where you essentially come into offshore pooling vehicle. I think you're going to still see the trend being that going towards a unified structure rather than having one single fund where everyone's going to come in.
Right. I think, Aditya, perhaps if you want to add.
So I think very quickly, the other point that you brought up was with respect to a unified investment structure versus a co-investment structure. And from a, and you know, while from a tax perspective, it's possibly clearer for a co-investment structure, you know, for a separate offshore fund to make investments into portfolio companies. I think there are certain commercial drivers which probably trump tax considerations. Not least among them is the fact that, you know, your domestic institutions, which tend to be a significant contribution, is pegged towards the overall fund size at the onshore fund level. So the minute you sort of segregate the funds, unless you're able to negotiate that, you know, the domestic institution's commitment is going to be linked to, you know, the overall sort of corpus of the offshore fund and the domestic fund, I think a unified investment structure continues to make sense if you're really looking to raise a very large corpus.
Yeah, but just to add to it, we still, the Indian GPs and how the Indian market has evolved, still we are ruled by what the LP, the foreign investor, would say. So accordingly, if the investor says that no, if you were to do a structure where the offshore fund is investing into the onshore fund, then clearly the decision at the AIF level becomes very critical on how the cash is upstreamed back to the offshore fund. So they may say that no, while you have an onshore fund for the Indian investors, I would want to have a co-investment through the offshore fund, because then I'm always relying on the certainty of the tax treaty and I'm not relying on what the taxation at the AIF level could be, etc. And frankly, given who foreign LPs are and that you as a GP would want to maintain that relationship, their requests even around tax issues sometimes sort of have a larger say than what you would otherwise, you know, sort of do for the overall platform. See, this is just a way to augment the AUM, and you would want to demonstrate that you have a track record of getting foreign LPs. So their wishes are usually taken care of. So I think apart from that, the only issue that I can see is that, you know, like Rajesh indicated, if you raise all the offshore commitments at the onshore level, you could consider it on a case of basis. Perhaps if your 80 to 90% of your, you know, raising is onshore, whereas, you know, only few LPs who you want to sort of have a relationship with is coming from offshore pool, you could perhaps think of raising an onshore-only sort of a platform so that you don't have to incur additional layer setup costs at a Mauritius or a Singapore or a Netherlands level. And of course, it adds its own administrative headache. And if a team is entirely out of India, do you have the bandwidth to take care of the offshore layer for the entire tenure of the fund, etc.? Those issues can also come into
play. So I think there's one other point I should add, which is the treaty benefits point, right, that you brought it up. At least with the postponement of GAR by a couple of years, I think you're going to have LPs getting more comfortable, let's say, even setting up a commercial structure, at least in the immediate future. I'm not talking about a long-term perspective, but at least in the immediate future, because otherwise they're always going to have the challenge as to whether treaty benefits are available or not in a unified structure. Also, I think that also has some degree of role to play in the positive sense. But again, something that's there in the medium term, but not necessarily in the long term, depending on how the car sort of comes into play.
Right. So moving back, Aditya, any reactions or comments on that the hedge funds, category 3 AIFs, have not been taken into the fold of the overall AIF tax platform under the new finance bill? What do you think would it mean for the, you know, the alternate investment strategies or derivative strategies, etc., if a GP who has some experience in an offshore context wants to launch a platform under Category 3 AIF? What is he looking at from a tax perspective?
Sure, I think, I mean, if you only need to look at the memorandum to the finance bill to see that while explaining why they've introduced this new tax regime for Category 1 and Category 2 AIFs, specifically sort of excluded hedge funds from, you know, the international example of pass-through, and probably not with much reason or thought, really. Now, the fact is that Category 3 AIFs are impacted on several levels. You know, the fact that Chapter 12 FP does not apply to them implicitly means that they continue to be governed by sections 160, 161, 161, 1A, and the July 28, 2014 circular, which means that they'll, in order to be eligible to for some sort of pass-through, they'll have to demonstrate that they're a determinate trust and that the names of their investors, etc., appear on the trust deed on the first day, in which in the case of a hedge fund is likely not going to really happen. You do have the ability to sort of cover yourselves under the revocable transfer provisions between Section 60 and 63 of the Income Tax Act, but as with the case of the tax positions in most other funds, the problem really arises with respect to whether the trustee is willing to take that point of view, because the way the trustee looks at it is, why take on the risk, the litigation risk of tax uncertainty with respect to whether the tax authorities will agree with Section 60 to 63. The case for using the provisions under the revocable transfer is that in the case of a hedge fund, you will have certain provisions relating to redemptions which are exercisable at the option of the contributor or the transferor, so to speak, and to that extent you should be allowed to claim that your contribution is actually a revocable transfer. But we've typically found that not many trustees are really willing to go with that position. And so I think Category 3 AIFs, hedge funds particularly, left out of this tax certainty bracket, maybe not really with much reason.
So I think you have to look at it slightly differently. Because one of the things that is there here is the fact that, let's say, if I was looking at a Category 3 AIF, more likely than not, the income stream which they would have really derived would have been profits and gains from business or profession. Which today, even if I apply the tests which are there currently under the finance bill in terms of the new provision, it effectively says that there is going to be a tax at the level of the AIF at a 30% tax. Mm-hmm. So even if, let's say, I have a Cat 3 AIF which is set up as a trust in India, I'm actually making investments as in any other hedge fund, what I'm really going to be earning is profits and gains from business or profession, which should have been taxed at a 30% rate in any event. I think, and this is where really, to my mind, Section 60 to 63, as to whether you can say that it is effectively a revocable trust comes into play. And at least when we go back and look at the decision of the Bangalore Tribunal in the India Advantage Fund case, where they have clearly said that, well, as far as the trust is concerned, we are going to look at it as a revocable trust based on the provisions of the trust deed. And as Aditya mentioned, in case of a hedge fund, the ability to probably justify yourself as a revocable trust actually increases because of some of the provisions relating to redemption. I think that alternative is still open, because that may probably end up giving you a bit more arbitrage if you treat yourself as a revocable trust, as opposed to probably treating yourself as a determinate trust, because in any event, it's still going to be a business trust where you're going to be taxed at 30%. As opposed to it, you may want to look at it as a revocable trust. So I think the argument is available, but again, fraught with some degree of risk as to the kind of litigation.
Right. No, I think just one other point I'll make over here is that, in the 2014 Finance Act, the second Finance Act, what the Finance Ministry really did was to provide a characterization for all securities that are held by a foreign institutional investor or foreign portfolio investor and characterize them as capital assets. And so the gains arising on them would by default be deemed to be capital gains. Now, a lot of course, hedge funds offshore are organized as foreign portfolio investors. And so I think one of the things that could have been considered by the government is really whether they wanted to create this differentiation between securities that are held by an offshore hedge fund as against securities that are held by an onshore hedge fund as a Category 3.
No, I agree with that if the characterization of the assets held by a Category 3 FPI, given that they follow the same strategy as a foreign portfolio investor, if all the investments are made under the purview of AIF regulation, then they could have been considered as capital assets. This is a critical issue as far as investors to a Category 3 hedge fund is concerned, because they would assume that the primary strategy is to invest on the floor of the stock exchange. If it's a long only fund where the period of holding is also more than 1 year, if I can be entitled to a tax exemption as soon as we have taken care of the STT,
then why should I consider a structure which just adds a layer of tax on top of what the taxes should be, number one? And number two, again, is this the payoff I have to consider when I'm considering a self-managed structure versus a discretionary platform, which is layered by a fund manager, as opposed to a portfolio management account that I can set up, which again, where all the shares or securities are traded in my own DMAT account, and accordingly, the taxation is as if I directly participate into the shares. So I think there are some issues, some aspects that need to be sort of rectified for a Category 3 AIF strategy to launch off. There are some players in the market, but of course, there are at a inflection point, because a lot of investors tend to sort of, compare whether are we better off by doing a self-structure, or should we come in through a layered structure of a AIF. So I think with that, if there's nothing else, then we can perhaps open to questions for the participants on phone.
Sure. Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Thank you. We have first question from the line of Bhavik Ambani from Ambit Investments. Please go ahead. Mr. Bhavik Ambani, your line is unmuted. You may please go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. My question here is that for a Category 3 fund, when there is a MAT paying company who's investing in that, there is a double layer of taxation. What is your view on that?
Rajesh, you want to take that?
So when you're talking about the double layer of MAT, so let's say you have a MAT paying company which has essentially invested. It depends again on how you have really categorized your Cat 3 AIF. If you have done it still as a trust, you are effectively going to have, let's say, your 30% tax as far as the trust is concerned.
Right.
Assuming for a minute that you don't have the revocability argument.
Right.
So you are effectively having a 30% tax, which is going to happen at the trust level.
Right.
And as far as the distributions are concerned, because I don't at least recall, they did make certain amendments to the MAT provisions this time as far as AOP is concerned. But not as far as, they have not said anything as far as these kind of distributions are concerned. So to a certain extent, obviously, that question will be there, saying that, but your argument that you can still possibly use is to say that, well, the trust is not really a person, so even though I have paid, the trust has paid a MMR, I should still be able to factor that in, even as far as MAT calculations are concerned. So I think you have to use, there are two or three arguments that you have to use to get yourself to that place, but is it cleared upfront? The answer is no.
Okay. So that is ambiguity still there.
Yeah.
Right. And just to add, so because from a MAT investor's perspective, if the fund is focusing only on few investors and a large component of that are MAT companies, etc., we have seen some of the fund operators also discussing, should we go down the path of setting up the fund as an LLP?
Right.
Because the distributions by an LLP are not computed or not taken into account as far as you computing your book profits are concerned from a MAT perspective.
Right. Okay, so that is an option for a fund to be set up instead of a trust.
Yeah, correct.
The challenge which comes in LLP is more, can get all the information of any LLP by paying.
We can get to it. So are there any other questions from the audience on phone? Otherwise, we'll take questions from the in person.
So there's one. There are two in the queue. Yeah. Should I forward that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have the next question from the line of Krishna Ramajan from Indistar Capital. Please go ahead.
My question is that the investment management fee, which the fund manager is going to charge the fund, will this be deductible from the unit holder's tax?
Right. No, so just to take a stab at it, to begin with, a management fee is for the overall fund platform. So sometimes it gets difficult, and I'll tell you where the debate has been on this point. It is difficult to attribute that the management fee, is it allocable to a particular deal or not?
And this becomes crucial because, you know, if let's say from a particular portfolio, the fund were to receive a dividend income, and if you were to attribute, you know, if the tax authority were to attribute management fee towards that, then there is a question of, you know, disqualifying the management fee as an expense because that expense was incurred towards earning an exempt income. So it becomes a Section 14A sort of an issue.
Sure, I'll just add very briefly over here. So, you know, most funds allow you the flexibility to take management fee upfront, or alternatively sort of take it at the back end, you know, at the time of making distribution. So at that point of time, you know, if your management fee is being allocated out of the proceeds that you get from the investment, then it's likely going to take the same character as the income of the fund.
Yeah, I think the challenge is going to be because I have effectively given you a partial pass-through in many senses of the term, it depends on the character of income which I'm getting. So, and since I'm going to be getting, let's say, potentially capital gains and let's say business income or dividends, I have both a 14A issue and also an allocability issue because I'm earning multiple different streams of income. So that becomes a challenge as far as management fees are concerned and as far as deductibility is concerned. So that will be difficult for you if you're going to be charging the fund for the management fees. It does become a bit of a challenge.
In fact, this issue has been brought out before different ITATs. A lot of the disputes lasted in 2-3 years earlier also in case of portfolio management services because those shares are credited directly to the demat account of the client. So can we then say that the fees that we are paying to the portfolio manager, can we take it out as an expense towards capital gains, dividends, etc., which is where there are some decided rulings, but the rulings go either way. So it's frankly a contentious position right now to take whether on a blind pool structure like a AIF, where you are looking at so many investors, would you want to go into issues or areas which are slightly grey?
Okay.
Next question, please.
Yes, sir. Our next question is from the line of Ajaz Popat from Piramal Group. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah.
See, my question is, in this finance bill, there is a classification of income in the nature of business and profession and all other incomes. Now, this classification is to be done in the hand of the fund, or suppose if there is any of the institutional investor or LP in a fund which may be considering the income distributed from the fund as his business income. So if you can throw some light on the classification, at whose hand will be relevant for this?
So I think that if you look at the finance bill, I think there are two different provisions which are there.
Hmm.
The first one, the first provision starts off by saying that whatever the AIF earns, the nature of the income is going to be dependent on the nature of income in the hands of the LPs.
Hmm.
And I think that's really to my mind the mother provision that is there. To say that, well, is it going to be a case where the AIF is going to pay tax, or is it going to be a case where it is going to be upstream? So that's the case-specific analysis which has to be done upfront. There is also one other provision which talks about where any distribution is actually made by the AIF and how that part takes the character depending on the investment strategy of the AIF.
Mm-hmm.
But to my mind, as in, you still have to go back to say that, well, I need to see what is this particular stream of income, and there I have to apply the pass-through principles, see whether it is going to be business income or capital gains, and accordingly I have to determine whether I pay tax, what is the quantum on which I pay tax, and what is the amount which is going to be effectively subject to pass-through.
And then just to add to it, I think one thing is very clear, both under the existing 115U, as well as the new regime which is being introduced under the new finance bill, that the characterization of income in the hands of the investor would be the same as the characterization of income when received by the fund.
Okay.
So unlike a true pass-through where you look at what is the characterization of income, had the income directly been received by the investor, so the trustee filing separate returns or taking separate views vis-a-vis each investor,
mm-hmm.
which ideally is the case in case of a true pass-through. Unfortunately, with the 150 new provisioning and the new bill, what happens is the investor will have to take the same position that the fund has taken. So you can't have, on the same stream of income, different positions taken by the different investors.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Sir, you may go ahead if there are any questions there. On the audio bridge at the moment, there are no questions.
Sure. If any come up on the pipeline, we'll be happy to take it. But at this stage, we'll take questions from the audience here.
I'm Archil Shah from Edelweiss. Some people have taken the view that for a Category 3 EIF, if you have a long-only structure with a determinate trust, it can be considered pass-through. Is this view correct?
So there, see, the position that you're taking, that if I'm doing a long-only, then effectively it is no longer profits and gains from business or profession, because what I'm really trying to earn is investment income. It's effectively a long-only strategy is similar to an investment income, and therefore I want to take the position that it is effectively a determinate trust which is earning capital gains, and therefore I'm trying to get a pass-through. I think that has been the position which they've been trying to follow, to say that because of the particular strategy which has been adopted, I'm going to take the position that the income which I'm earning is capital gains. The at least in the Indian context, today we don't have any bright line test as to determine when a particular stream of income is going to be capital gain and when a particular stream of income is going to be profits and gains from business or profession. And this has been subject to a lot of debate, and there have been a lot of precedents and court cases which have come in, and also there have been circulars which have issued by the CBDT providing certain guidelines as to when a particular stream of income can be classified as business income or as capital gain. And if I'm as a long-only fund, yes, you can potentially look at taking, adopting a position that, listen, since my strategy itself is effectively a long-only, and these are effectively not what I would call, these are all investment income as far as I'm concerned, and not necessarily business income, and therefore I'm trying to take the pass-through benefit. Whether it will work or not is a pure fact and circumstances, ultimately.
So if I do a long-only strategy, should there be no trading? I should just hold it for 367 days or something, or I can also have short-term trading in a few stocks.
So today nothing precludes you from having two different books. So one which will contain your trading activities, and one which contains your investment activities. That has been recognized by courts to be completely fine, saying that even within, let's say, one particular entity or one particular fund, nothing precludes me from having, let's say, a short-term trading and a long-term investment. So long as I can make that bifurcation, I will still be able to take advantage. If I can't make that bifurcation, I have an issue.
There again are decided cases in PMS context. Like, as a PMS client, can I like then make a claim that, okay, I am maintaining two different books? But I think one of the arguments that the authority also brings up is, okay, you are taking assistance A of a professional manager. So you are actually looking at it in something which is more professionally organized, even the frequency of trading, etc. So I think there was a circular which came out.
That's for PMS, right?
Correct.
But even there, if you think about it, merely because I use the benefit of a professional manager, which is the same thing I use in an AIF, whether I'm CAT 1 or CAT 2 also, doesn't necessarily change. It's all dependent on the strategy that you are actually adopting as far as
and how you have all yourself recorded in your own.
Correct.
Okay. Are there any questions on through the phone line or?
Participants, if anyone wishes to ask a question, please press star and one at this time. Anyone who has a question may press star and one. We have a question from the line of Avinash G from Stratus Financial Services. Please go ahead.
Yes, sir. Here I am going to ask the question about how this withholding tax of 10% will be affecting in the long term, like in a term of 1 year or 2 year, how the scope will be for this.
No, so I think clearly this 10% withholding as a concept was introduced because there is a debate between the industry and the department that what should be the basis on which a pass-through should be afforded. So on one hand, while the industry was clamoring that, okay, there should be a pass-through, and such is anyways the norm across all mature geographies where funds are operated, there is a pass-through sort of an entitlement to the investors in the fund. what the authority was saying that, you know, with so many investors coming into our AIF or a fund platform, it is difficult for the revenue to sort of, you know, make sure that everyone has paid taxes properly, etc. So they would want one point of taxation, which is at the fund level, which allows the tax department or the particular officer of a circle with the trustees paying taxes to sort of, you know, collect at one nodal point a 10% withholding, and then allowing the investors to take either a credit of the withholding or to pay the balance taxes, depending on how they are sort of set up. So I think that was how the entire discussion started. Clearly, there is lot of issues which are, you know, yet to be addressed. The language used under the provision also needs some amount of rectification. Perhaps instead of saying income, they should have said income accessible to tax or chargeable to tax, which would have eliminated either A, exempt incomes like dividend or long-term capital gains, or B, it would have taken into account what is the nature of the investor. If they are an exempt investor or if they are relying on a treaty and that particular stream of income is in that case exempt, then those sort of situations would have also been taken into account. So clearly, while withholding tax is perhaps a compromise between a true pass-through or what we had previously, a no pass-through sort of situation, which was open to debate with the department, versus a withholding which is less than perfect solution. So I think withholding as a concept would remain, but you would expect, and it is quite prudent to expect, that some amount of relaxation on the language, so that, you know, you can take into account the different variations of income stream and who the investor is, should come in. But I think to expect all these changes by the time the bill crystallizes into act could be difficult. So perhaps you might see something happening by the next finance bill, if at all.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone who has a question may press star and one. So currently here there are no questions on the audio bridge.
No, so I think with that then I think we'll conclude the discussion. I think just to summarize where we are, I think clearly the industry should be at least be happy that at some level we have achieved a pass-through, something that the industry has been clamoring for quite some time now. Of course, the solution has been less than ideal. The government clearly seems to be looking at the right direction, but taking steps in a different direction. Because the language does not allow a clean pass-through as what was expected. And there are certain flaws that continue to remain. Having said that, this does assure some amount of certainty, to the whole platform. So which I think augurs well for how the industry will progress. But clearly there are some issues which need to be addressed. I think with that we will conclude the discussion. Thanks, Rajesh. Thanks, Aditya. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference call. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.